but that aren't good enough to publish. And I do that all the time. And because people want an honest appraisal. If they're paying me for an evaluation, I tell them no. And I've told, you know, people who have published books already who wanted to go back and do another book, I said, there's nothing here. You know, for, and it depends what the problem is. And that's hard to do. And you try to do it gently and gracefully. But yeah, you've got to give people an honest response.
My experience with that situation is to talk with people about where the what the limitations are that I see, and sometimes they get defensive, and it's really important for me to talk them through their defensiveness and to give them objective feedback so they're not wasting their time pushing something. And I always do firm estimates. I say, this is the maximum it's going to cost. I'll keep my clock ticking, and if I can save you 10%, 15%, I'm glad to do that. But, yeah, I don't want anybody to get into a project and then say, oh my God, I didn't know it was going to be $12,000.
The other difference is when you're in-house, you're the last word. I mean, the author's the last word. It's the author's book. But as an editor, it's between you and the author. Where I am now, I'm not the last word because it's going to go to a publisher. And so the end game, you don't have to make it perfect. You just have to get it onto somebody else's plate because they're going to have their own spin on it. And also the big change nowadays is self-publishing, where...
Independent
publishing. Independent, thank you. So that opens up other possibilities.
A comment on independent publishing. I'm going to put in a plug here. I was going to wait for later. For the Bay Area Independent Publishers Association, which is a network of people working in all aspects of independent publishing, from writers, editors, book designers, marketing people, printers. It's a great organization, meets the second Saturday of every month in San Rafael, baida.org. Website's dreadful, but within 6 weeks we'll have a brand new website. A lot of what comes out of there, I try to be nice because I'm on the board. I try to be nice to people and buy their books and take a good look. It's sort of hard when you've bought somebody's book and you bought it from them, and a month later they see you and they want to say, what did you think? But most people, or many people who do independent publishing, do not realize that the reason they can't market is because the writing just isn't good enough. It just doesn't stand up. And independent publishers are often budget publishers and don't want to invest in an editor, or they're intimidated about it. If I find a project, I met someone at the San Francisco Writers Conference last year who had a beautiful book against the setting of the Vietnam War, though it wasn't a war book. It was a colonel and his driver in 1975 when the driver was airlifted out. And the two of them were trying to find each other because the driver needed a sponsor to come to be able to get into the U.S. And the colonel's father was an Italian immigrant who had worked in the coal mines in West Virginia and ended up owning a bank. And the colonel felt so supportive of bringing this guy into the potential, to his full potential. It's a beautiful story. And the woman didn't have any money. So I said to her, I'm going to keep track of my hours. When this gets sold, because I'm sure it will, I get the first cut. And sometimes you just feel that way about a project. Hasn't sold yet. But a few agents are taking their time with it. That's positive.
Questions? I could talk for days, so...
I had a question for both of you. My name is Malay. I'm a fiction writer, definitely amateur, working on a first novel and a short story collection. A follow-up to something Jay said about, like, you don't do fantasy. my question is, how do you match your genre to get, like, mine is domestic drama set in India. I wouldn't call it ethnic fiction, but it's a specific backdrop. So how do I go about finding someone who, you know, will resonate with that material and genre and help me along?
You can look at websites. You're talking about for editors? You look at websites and see the books they've done. And a lot of editors do everything, all types of fiction and nonfiction.
Is there like the association that David mentioned, is there a Bay Area editors where you could just post and say, I'm seeking an editor?
There is, and it meets right here at Mechanics Institute, the Bay Area Editors Forum, which is editorsforum.org, and you can go to their website, and there's a place to submit a request, and you put it out there and you see who responds, because all the members get an email copy of what you sent in.
So a follow-up to that would be, how important is that? I mean, should I be trying to find someone who's done exactly that, or is it more about the relationship, how you play off each other, the kind of feedback you get?
Yes. It's always about the relationship with your agent and with the editor. You need to get somebody who shares your vision. You don't want to take someone kicking and screaming. You know, they have to believe in it, otherwise you're in trouble from the beginning. That said, I know a lot of well-respected freelance editors, Alan, who believes, you know, a novel's a novel, whether it's young adult or whatever it is, and the principles are the same, and so he doesn't draw these distinctions between genres and for me, since part of what I do is, part of what writers usually want is to know the publishability, and if I'm not familiar with what's being published in that area, I just don't feel in good conscience that I want to take it on and advise them to do a little bit of this or a little bit of that if I'm not reading and familiar with it. But, you know, people should tell you that, you know, and when you talk to them or when you look at their website, you'll be able to figure it out.
Anybody you hire, you should be able to have a good rapport with and make sure that they can give you what you want. So if you start into the process, I had someone talk to me about possibly working with me who had given a book to an editor and it came back and he hated it. And he paid like $16,000, I don't know, some outrageous amount of money. So one of the things I do is, first, long conversation, make sure that we're speaking the same language, that we have, I like to have a sense of humor with my people, to have a lightness and a kindness. I want them to know that they're heard. And the first thing I do, if we get into an actual editing, is to work on the first chapter, send it back, get feedback, do that back and forth until they feel like I understand what it is they want. Within the parameters, I call it arm wrestling. If I disagree with my client, I don't ever do anything arbitrarily is an editing suggestion. I like to preserve what's there as much as possible and make it flow. And I will argue my point with somebody, and ultimately the author is in charge of the process, so they're going to make their decision. But I want to give them a professional reflection on where that's going. But I'm just taking a book for a client into a designer, and I asked my friend who's a designer, he said, I'm too busy, go call so-and-so. Well, to me, the most important thing is that I have a good working relationship with her. I don't care what she produces in the first round, but when I give her feedback about what I want on that first round, I want the second round to meet me where I need to be. So that capacity to communicate is really important. I want to feel at home, and I love Chitra Devakaruni. I just love her.
I was interested in you're saying that sometimes people, maybe half the time a client comes in thinking it's a memoir, but it's really a novel or vice versa. And I'm wondering if you have this situation. I'm Mary, I'm new to this area, and I'm a published author, and I'm now teaching private students. So this is something that I run into, and I wonder if you find this, and then what do you do? Someone can come with a manuscript they work, this has happened to me recently now, someone can come with a manuscript they work for years on. It's, you know, you go through it maybe initially like you did, and it's really not jumping off the page. You know, it's very safe, it's very defended, it's very proficient, the person knows how to use the language, but it's not moving in any way. But then you find something on page 55, you find a paragraph that absolutely blows you away, and you say to the person, you know, I have done this, because I don't think this is the novel that, you know, that it, this is not really what the novel, you think this is the novel's about this, but really, what happens here? And then they read that out loud to you, and they start choking up, right? Because it's a place where really the vein is there, and they just, the rest falls away like scaffolding, and they maybe write in that vein, and they come up with stuff that's, you know, gorgeous. It's the story that needs to be told, that is too scary or too risky or too this or too that. They don't have a situation which they feel safe enough to do it on their own. Stuff like that. And I'm wondering, I would think that you get that also, right? Not just with the memoir fiction, but maybe someone comes in with a fiction. It is really a novel.
Well, I think you're right. What you want to find, what the story is really about, what the person really wants to say, what turns you on as a reader, what seems to be turning them on.
Yeah.
And when you find it, then you say, well, why are you writing this as a novel when it really, so, you know, no offense, but this messed up person seems to be you, you know. or whatever it is. And they say, well, I was afraid of, you know, that I would get sued because the people would be, you know, or they come out with reasons that aren't very good reasons. And you say, well, you know, what's driving this story is the fact that it really happened to someone. And it doesn't have the arc of a novel, so you really should write it as nonfiction. Or the reverse, and I've gone both ways,
yeah,
to turn fiction into nonfiction and nonfiction. And you try and find out what's really there and what they really want to do. And usually, or often, it is from that spark. It's like you step on a hot wire or something. Mm-hmm. You know it when you hit it. Mm-hmm. And people's reasons for thinking they want to do one or the other are often something that someone else has told them, mm-hmm, rather than what they really feel, or, you know, and so that becomes part of the discussion.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just a matter of crossing out the word that says a novel and writing a memoir. It's a little trickier than that, and you're not as protected from libel as you think you are if you write a novel, and you don't have to stick to the truth as much as you think you do if you're writing a memoir. You can't lie about anything that's material to the book or to your story. You can't say, you know, I survived in the Himalayas for 4 years with no food or water if that didn't happen. But there's for minor peripheral things, you have some ability to fudge, and that's okay. It's just you can't cheat on the big points. Another thing that happens frequently is that someone will come with a story of my year in the garden, or, you know, my year in whatever it is, and the memoir that they want to tell, they will have framed as a year, mm-hmm, and I'll say, why a year? You know, you've been living there for, you know, 10 years. Why? Well, I thought it would give it structure. You're artificially limiting the story. There might have been interesting things that happened outside of that framework. You don't have to narrow what you're doing artificially.
They took actually a year. They didn't use it as a structure, but they just actually limited. It's a year.
They thought it'd be easier. You know,
yeah.
January, you know, this,
yeah,
and February. It makes, you know, they thought it'd be easier, but it wasn't as interesting. And there were lots of good things I could have talked about outside of that. And so that's another topic that comes up a lot. You know, why did you choose this focus? Those are the types of discussions you want to have early on. You don't have to tell the story of your whole life. You know, I was born at a young age, but you can focus on something that happened at a particular time.
Sure.
One event, taking your kid to a soccer game or something, can really be the basis of the memoir, and you know, rather than feeling everybody cares about everything you ever did, which is not true.
No. Mary, that's a great point, actually. There is something often so pithy, and the author doesn't see it, and that you can structure everything around that and link all the information they want to convey to that place.
Yeah, or a bunch of new information comes because they go there and so much is happening in an unconscious way, maybe, and they get to that particular kernel and the whole world comes up all of a sudden, and, you know, it's just at a different level. I mean, that's how I thought, maybe, you know, what do you do when it happens, you know?
You talk.
Yeah, that's good.
Let me ask some questions. I assume the people here are thinking that they might want to use an outside editor, a freelance editor. Is it mainly because you're stuck in the book? How many people would think of using an editor? Not whether you are at the minute, but is it at the moment. Is the idea that an editor is someone who helps you when you run into a wall and can't go any further? Is that the... How many people... No. How many people think it's because an editor might be helpful because their book is done and they really want to get it out into the world? And okay. So, somewhat more people at the done stage than... It's a different process when you're working with a writer early on. There's that delicate pilot light of creativity, you know, that is just the work is beginning, and you want to not blow it out by being too harsh. But if you're working with someone who thinks their book is ready to go out to an agent or a publisher, you're in a different role. You blow on it. You know, if it needs it, you've got to say, look, this isn't what you think it is. The plot's a mess, or whatever it is. And so it's very important to have the relationship and understand what the author wants, where they're coming from, and where the book really is. And people do come in and with a novel that's clearly based on their own story, and you don't want to say something like, you know, this is a really unlikable character, and this, you know, and so you have to be, you know, whether or not they're officially the character or not, you know, and that's happened. I know people who have gotten that feedback from agents and publishers. This is, when it's a memoir and you get it, it's a little harder to explain away. But I've done that too.
Jay, do you want to talk about fiction or nonfiction?
How many people are doing fiction? And how many people are doing nonfiction? Oh, mostly fiction. Well, one of the differences, and how many people are thinking of self-publishing? And how many people are thinking of publishing with a commercial publisher? And how many people would write even if they didn't publish? There you go. Thank you. That's the best answer. The main difference, and there are exceptions to every rule, but usually fiction is written before it's sold to a publisher, and the exception is if you're a well-known author, you can sell it on the basis of a title, and your next book, you know, if you've got the track record. And some genre fiction, you can get away with not writing the whole book. But usually, I think you'd be safe in assuming you've got to write the novel before you can talk to an agent or get a publisher interested. For nonfiction, it's different. As I started to say a little earlier, most nonfiction is sold on the basis of a book proposal. And that's what my class at the end of the month talks about, is how to do a book proposal and what it is. But that's the major difference between fiction and nonfiction when you're looking to do it commercially. And what an editor would do, to keep trying to bring the discussion back to that, if you're working on a proposal, then what you're working on with the writer is not the four corners of the manuscript. It's the broader things that you need to include in a proposal, competitive book research and marketing and your bio and things like that, that that wouldn't necessarily come into play with a novel. Yes, Taryn.
How far in advance, if you are thinking about it, other than sort of deciding it's a feasible project at all, when, at what point do you write the proposal?
Good question.
Do you want to answer it?
No. No.
I want to hear the answer.
You know, it really depends on what the project is, and you know, if it's something that how competitive it is in the world. If it's something that only you could write about, you know, if it's the History of the Mechanics Institute book.
That's been done.
Well, see, that's why you do your research first. Before you spend all that time, you do a preliminary amount to see whether the idea has been done. Mm-hmm. You know, so, you know, is it something that you really want to go ahead and do regardless of whether there's another book out there? You know, are you going to collect your family recipes? Are you going to tell people how to do Pilates in the, you know, anyway? You know, or is this something you're only going to write so you can sell it? So that those are factors on that. But you should do a certain amount of research first. I mean, it doesn't have to be extensive to see if how good the idea is, what's out there, you know, has it been done? And then what part of what a proposal is a sample chapter. So you have to do some writing anyway, but you need to organize the, outline the book and do a table of contents. And you, as David was saying, an outline can be really important for nonfiction. So I would go ahead and do the table of contents and the outline and do your preliminary research and then write it. Because a lot of times it could be a great idea, and you can't write for beans, you know, and so that's a factor that the agent and the editor needs to work with too. But a lot of work goes into shaping what the book should be, and you don't have to write the whole book. Another thing that's very helpful to do is write an article on the topic that you want to do the book on, and in many instances, the article will, A, get you some money right away if you sell the article. It will give you credibility in the publishing world, because here you've been published by, you know, The Atlantic or House Beautiful or whatever it is. And also, the article can become part of the proposal. Under the Tuscan Sun, when it came in as a proposal, was three articles that she had written for different magazines. And that was pretty much the writing sample. And they were all... It was kind of messy because there were different magazines and they had different styles, and anything that's been published already, you don't know how much the author has written and how much has been edited. So it, you know, but it was, you know, that was the writing sample.
Did you handle that?
Yeah.
It's a lovely book.
That was such a sweet smile, Renee.
Yeah. Yes.
Yes, if you're writing a nonfiction book in which images are important, and they'd be your own, when you're sending in a sample chapter, I understand that. How many images?
Yes, if the book is, well, again, this is getting into, you know, this isn't what a freelance editor does, but it's logical. If the book is going to be visual, you got to get some visuals as part of the proposal. And they should be good visuals.
Yes.
And you should also give an idea of, you know, the book's going to have 200 photographs. Here's, you know, 15 samples, you know.
Okay.
So you've got to explain the scope and then give some samples. And then, you know, whatever the book is, the proposal has to include elements of all of it. If there's going to be recipes, you got to put in recipes. You know, if there's going to be photos, you got to put in the photos.
One question I had was, you know, I make it a point to read nice writers, you know, it makes me a better writer, but what I don't get out of it is, what did draft one look like? So from your experience, what kind of leaps happened if you've shepherded a project from, say, draft one to a finished novel, like I'm more interested in, happen, and is there a pattern, like the biggest leap is from draft one to draft two, or it could be anything?
I think it's so specific to the project and the author. I mean, in my own work, I've written fiction, I've done nonfiction. Each piece is its own phenomenon. And we get stuck or we're blind. And that's when it's really important to get feedback from a professional and get support for knowing how to proceed.
Yeah, I mean, part of what I'm trying to say myself is, of course, I will need objective external help. Like, I've been part of a writer's group for nearly 10 years, so that helps. But also, I find myself wanting to become a better and better self-critiquer. And I saw in one of David's questions written, like, about teaching you how to write. So I was wondering how much you get into that, besides commenting on a specific material, trying to kind of convey patterns or things that would make me a better self-critiquer.
It does vary, as David said. There's no magic. A lot of times, manuscripts have been through many drafts before they get to me, and at some point it does coalesce as good. It does get as good as it's going to get, you know. But that it's hard to reduce that. There are two extremes again. Sometimes writers get too much advice. I mean, I think writers' groups are great. And writing programs and writing workshops can be great, but there's problems with them, I think. With someone who's in the writing program at San Francisco State or Iowa or wherever it is, I mean, it's everyone's homework to pay attention to the manuscript that you've brought in that day. So they're going to read it no matter what. And that's, you're not going to get that from an audience when you go out into the world. You know, there's this hothouse effect that you get sometimes from writers' workshops, and if it's just that boring, no one's going to get to page 300. You know, so you get spoiled sometimes if you're in a writing group or a writing workshop. On the other hand, people often feel they have to have an opinion, and you get 10 different opinions. And the people are full of shit, you know. I mean, they don't, and so that's a problem of how do you know if that's good advice or not? And the same goes with the feedback that I give to a writer. The last thing I want is a writer who takes everything I suggest and doesn't, because I can't possibly have channeled them that well. So you as the writer have got to figure out what resonates. What advice did you saw that do you go, that's it. You know, that makes sense. That's what I was trying to do. Or that, you know, that's a better way to do it. And that's what we as editors try to give you our experience and our feedback as to what's working. But ultimately, you've got to make the call. And sometimes, you know, the mistake that a young editor makes, and we're not young editors, but new editors, newbie editors, they make the mistake of not responding to what the author is trying to do, but responding to the editor's own idea of what the book might be.
Some old editors do that too.
And so, you know, the editor can write his own book, as some editors do, but you've got to work with what the author's intentions are and what's going to bring out the best that the author's trying to do. And you can't say, no, this book should really be set in, you know, just because you liked Paris, you know. That's more of an editor's problem than a writer's problem. But the idea is that for the writers, you've got to take the advice that seems to work for you and leave out the noise. How you become your own best critic, I don't know. You don't want to censor yourself too soon. That's why editors have a hard time being good writers generally, because they start editing before they start writing, and then there's nothing there. So you want to let it go out first. You know, flex your muscles, get it out on the page. You'd rather write too much than too little, and then wear a different hat and try and look at it. And the other advice that I always give, and then I'll shut up for a bit, is when you think you're done with a manuscript, put it in the drawer for as long as you can stand, at least a month. These days, I don't know if it's a drawer, it's, you know, if it's not on paper, but don't tinker with it, don't look at it, just get distance from it, and then pick it up and read it again with fresh eyes. And invariably, you will find all these things that you feel you would like to change. And the worst thing that people do, they're so excited, they finish their book, they print it out, they put it in an envelope, and they send it off to an agent or an editor or somebody like that. And, you know, we don't get to things the same day. And so in the interim, some time goes by, and then the writer said, oh my God, I will have a new ending. Here's a new opening. You're dead. If you do that to an editor or publishing house or an agent, you will never be taken seriously. So you've got to get it right before you send it out. Everyone knows it'll go through more changes, more editing later on. Don't worry. And changing a semicolon to a comma on page 300 is not going to make a difference. So don't tinker, you know. But give yourself time after you've written it, and then make your changes. Did you want to jump in?
Well, I think...
I have a quick follow-up question.
Sure.
I just wanted to know what you thought is the ideal amount of time to wait. I can do exactly that after I finish my first draft.
It depends how long you've been working on it and what you're, you know, how much. But I would say a month is easy. I mean, it seems like forever.
I think longer. I was planning to wait for a month.
At least a month if you can. But I mean, don't look at it, you know. Yeah, get a life, you know, exactly. Do something else.
Exactly.
You know.
I was going to say 4 to 6 months.
Really?
Yeah, you really want to forget it. So when you look at it, it feels like you've never seen it before. Yeah, I have one book that's been through about 26 drafts over 6 years, and they're long hunks. And one of the recommendations, I love to read aloud, and I love language that flows through the mouth and into the ear, is as a close to final editing, is to read it into a recorder, see how it feels coming out of your mouth, and then a few weeks later come back and listen to it and see how it sounds. I find that an incredibly powerful project, and I've done it twice on this particular manuscript. I wanted to get back to your first question. I don't think of myself as much interested in science fiction or thrillers, or I like stuff that moves out of people's hearts and opens the reader's heart, which those two genres tend not to. But I just got a call from a guy who's written a psychological thriller, and I took a look at it, and he's a good writer. It's literary. He's an intelligent person. He has a background in law enforcement and in psychology. And I said, I'm willing to do a read-through because of who you are and how this is touching me. So it really depends. Yeah.
To move to a different point about timing, one other thing that happens a lot when people are looking for editors is that the writer too quickly wants to go to the copy edit, or too quickly wants to polish the sentence structure on the page. And you know, people contact me and say, you know, I want you to do basically a line edit or a copy edit of this manuscript. And it's very, very rare that we will see something that's ready to go at that level. And sometimes people come to me with manuscripts that have already been line edited, where the person is paid to have, you know, someone go through and correct all the grammar and remove the duplication of expressions and things like that. And sometimes it's been done by friends of mine. And it's the problems with the manuscript are much larger than that. And they've basically wasted their money. And even because it's the big problems or the big issues with the book are not on the grammatical level. And even though it sometimes seems the last thing you want to hear is that your book needs an evaluation from an outside editor just when you thought it was ready to go to an agent and publisher, I strongly think that could be the best investment of time at that stage, is to get the appraisal and do the big work that's necessary before you polish the china on the Titanic. any more questions here?
I want to make some comments, just thoughts coming up. How many people have suffered through their first chapter, written their book, and then come back and realize the first chapter doesn't make any sense? How many people have started with the first chapter? The same people. Yeah, first chapters are really hard. It's different in fiction. My experience, looking at my own writing in fiction, is you want setting, you want history, you want character, you want to set the tone for the whole piece, and you're trying to cram much too much information into what the reader can absorb. And I suffered my first chapter through a lot of editings. It just kept getting smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. I think it went from 26 pages to about 6 in the end. And the information that was necessary came out at the time that was necessary, and you need to be patient with yourself around that.
I've written The Great American Paragraph. a lot of times what will happen is that the kernel of the idea of the novel, the image or the scene or that got the writer going, winds up being cut when the book is all done. It's like the sourdough starter, and you know, and make the bread. And there was one writer who was doing a mystery, and what she wanted to do was have the murder take place during the crush, in the giant vat. This guy was going to get stomped and killed, and they were going to find him in the vat during after the harvest of the grapes. And she could not get that scene to work. I mean, it just wasn't factually possible. And she struggled and struggled, and then eventually, you know, she killed the guy some other way. A great mystery series, you know, up in Napa. But you know, what it was that excited her, what she came in with, just wasn't going to work. And she really spent a lot of time trying to force it. And you just said, you know, no, it's not working. This doesn't. You're working too hard. You can see it as when you read a book. You're working too hard at too peripheral a point. It's feeling labor. Get rid of it. You don't need it. And that's the type of advice. It's very hard to see yourself because you love it. Yeah.
You know, so I guess similar to what you were just talking about, especially about novel to end and somehow just can't get. Mm-hmm. And what do you do at that point? How do you
work? Talk to them about what they're trying to do and how what they tried and what's working and what's not working. There are a couple of, sometimes books end sooner. That it really ends 50 pages before the writer stops typing, you know. Sometimes what they think is the ending isn't the ending. And a lot of times it's not the ending, it's the point of the book. I mean, you're running out of energy and pages and you gotta have, it's got to come together, and the problem is you don't know what the book's about. Is sometimes the problem. You know, it's great you've described this cocktail party and you've taken this cruise, and okay, and now what? What's the point? And if the writer knows the point, then it's much easier to get there. That you can help with, because you can bring it out and elicit it and figure out what scenes and what the characters need to do. If the writer doesn't know the point, that's a bigger problem.
Often when I'm first talking with a client, I'll ask them what they want the reader to take away from the experience. You know, who's the audience, and what do you want the reader? And it's very important to know the audience to voice it properly, because well-educated people aren't going to read bad writing. Or you don't want to write over the head of the audience that you want to touch. And that gets involved with the ending. Hold on one second, Renee. One of the things that I find really useful as an editor is to ask people for a chapter by chapter synopsis so that before I start reading, I know what their intention is and where they're going to see if they're building it properly. And a tool that I've only ever seen one person use is to map each chapter and each, so you, like a spreadsheet, so chapter one and then a list of the characters and what their action is in that and what the reader learns. Because you don't want to give the story away in the first chapter. You want to slowly build the reader's interest, because if they get the point, they're going to stop reading. And maybe you've sold the book, but they're going to get an unsatisfactory experience out of it. And when I was at the San Francisco Writers Conference, I was talking to a guy and suggesting he do that. He opens his portfolio, and there he has an Excel spreadsheet, just like I described. But one of the things that does is you don't want a character in chapter 16 opening a door with his left hand when he's lost his left hand in chapter 7. And that will, and I've seen manuscripts in which that's happened. And that you want to be able to catch that before you pay an editor to catch it. So knowing what's going on in an objective way away from the content is a really good process.
It depends also how everybody likes to work. Some people like to work from outlines, and some people like to work from scenes or characters. You know, everybody, there's a fixed rule. But for mysteries, I really think you need an outline like something like that, or I call it a storyboard, like in the movies, where you figure out how the book's going to progress. And I've worked with writers where we started with nothing but the idea. Okay, let's do a mystery. I had an idea for two series, and I found writers, and I said, okay, we're going to do one series set in Napa, one series set in Silicon Valley, and we met every week or every other week for a long time working, and the books were written from just that core idea, and they both turned into series that did really well. But that's a matter of mapping it out, knowing where you're going.
Yeah. Renee, you had a question?
How is the process of editing children's books and dissimilar?
Children's books is one of the categories that I don't do myself, though I know lots of good editors. But when you're talking, are you talking about picture books or chapter books or young adult? Because they're all different.
I think ideally the book that I have written would probably be best illustrated, but it could fly in really brief form without illustration. So I'm just wondering how this
Well, it children's books, the young adult category has changed enormously since Harry Potter and The Hunger Games and some other books, and it's kind of broken out. But let's not talk about young adult, because that's unto itself, and it doesn't sound like you're talking about young adult if you're thinking illustrated. There are very specific requirements that children's books have. For picture books, you know, there are 32 pages, there's so many words on the page. It's a misconception that the writers need to be the illustrators or even no illustrators. There's nothing delights a children's book editor more at a publishing house than finding an artist to match the text. So you can be an artist or you can be a writer, you don't have to be both. And often it works against you if you submit both, because one is usually better than the other, and you're going to be held back if the writing is good but the art is terrible. You know, you're going to hold back your chances. So if it's a chapter book, then there's certain length that it has to be, and certain sophistication for the language. If it's middle grade, you know. So you've got to know that if you're writing a book. If you're going to try and go into the children's market, you have to have a sense of what age group, what level of sophistication, and what the components are of what you're trying to do. If it's young adult, you can just write it, because that's more of a free-for-all. And these days, the young adult stuff is much racier and much than adult stuff. I mean, you couldn't publish adult books, and it's a great category. And it's a growth category, young adult. So I don't know if that answers your question. I don't myself do that, but that's the game.
Would a children's editor be able to place the age range, for example, of a manuscript?
Yes, but you should have a sense of that, because there's such different components. I mean, if a picture book, you know, you're having 8 to 15 words on a page, it can't be sophisticated language. I mean, they're not going to say, you know, you have to have a sense of, they will do that, but you need to go in with a sense of that. You know, you can't say, you know, this is for kids. It's going to be a picture book, but it's very sophisticated concepts and language. You know what I mean? The editor will say, no, you're wrong. You know, the writing's too old for the format, and you'll be out in 2 seconds. They're not going to, you know, help you through that. I mean, you've got to have a, you know, a freelance editor can yes, but not an editor or publishing has. So you know, you should, and it's amazing how. Many people don't understand the basics. I mean, because of children's books, and they're so short. A picture book, you know, is on a page. You're on one page. You can write a whole picture book. You know, if you give a mouse a cookie, you know, it's like one page. So people, oh, it's easy. You know, I can write 50 children's books. You know, but it's very hard. To do a children's book, very hard, and every word and every concept is very carefully done.
So. I want to support what Jay is saying, and I want to add that I want readers to learn to appreciate good writing, and even if they're very young readers, I want the language to be playful, I want it to be a delight to read, and I want it to be as sophisticated as their minds can handle. So good writing is really important, even with kids' books. Beautiful language is really important.
But if you're not thinking about young adult and you're not thinking picture books, you're thinking, then you can go ahead and write it, because chapter books or middle grade readers, that's fuzzy enough, you know. But if you're thinking it might be illustrated with color illustrations, that's a different game.
Give advice on research? Do you have instances where you feel that it could be anything, research about the industry or time period or place?
You mean like you don't know what you're talking about?
I know you can get lost in research, like yeah. Probably all have. Once you start on the internet, there's no end to it. So often I develop the story first and then see what research demands. I'm just wondering.
It depends again how you work and how much it's your area of expertise. It's real easy to get lost in the research, and I've worked a lot with newspaper reporters, and they can't seem to get out of the research. And you got to start writing this sucker, you know. And they're researching. No, so that can be a real danger. On the other hand, if you don't know what you're talking about, at some point, then you're going to have to redo it all. So it's just a balance. And a lot of the writers have researchers who, the best-selling writers, you know, have a staff. You know, James Michener, you know, he didn't do all that stuff himself. But yes, you've got to balance the. It's a matter of balance, research and writing, and when you do it. It depends. You know, it depends what it is and how central it is to the story.
But do you recommend to interleave it with writing? Sounds like rather than trying to do upfront research.
Whatever gets you going. You know, if you're writing. The words are pouring out every day, and you're writing. Keep writing, and then you can go back and fill in. If you're really enjoying the research, and you're not sure whether the character is going to die in the wine crush or not, and you got to figure out, then do some more research. But but don't get lost. It happens a lot with mysteries where people get so fascinated with the technique of it. And yeah, you need procedure, and you need. You need detail, but it, at some point it's got to be in service. There's got to be some reward.
The longest book I never wrote was was an outline, and a beautifully articulated outline. And I realized that I needed to know a lot more about turn of the 20th century Russia to pull it off, and I had no desire to stop my process and go do the research, and the outline sitting somewhere in a file cabinet in my house. It stopped the flow. You know, I could have started writing it at a certain point. I could have done the research and come back, because I would have been more excited to push through that process.
Sometimes the whole story is in the details, and then that's a different. You know, too much of it is dependent upon. You can't write, you know, a 17th century. If you have no idea what was going on in the 17th century, you know.
And
you can't.
I see huge, even in good, say, novels, there's a huge variation in density. Some writers revel in the detail, you know, what type of leather was on the shoe. Others are more character and inner life focused. So I think style matters too.
And readers are going to be the same way. Some of them are going to say, hey, I want more of a central experience than this writer is giving me. But that's what that writer is interested in and has to offer. So it's really a sense of balance. I just had an incident. It was a guy, San Francisco Writers Conference was a few weeks ago, and I met a guy there who, he's from Lebanon, but has a PhD in creative writing from the University of Texas. And he had a manuscript he wanted me to look at, and I read the first chapter, and I said to him, so your character is sitting on the stump of a fig tree that was cut down 10 years ago. My experience with fig trees is that the roots sprout up, or if that's not happening, then the root would have died, would have rotted away over 10 years. And he said, it's artistic license. And I don't have a good enough relationship with him to say, hold on to your artistic license that you learned about in studying in graduate school, but no publisher's going to go near it, and this is the first chapter. So you have to be in some alignment with reality, especially these days. Maybe 50 years ago, artistic license could get you further, but we have a very sophisticated audience of readers right now.
Without saying this is the rule, there's also a trend that as male readers get older, they tend to read more for fact. They read more nonfiction. They read history, biography. And if they read fiction, it's the Tom Clancy type of fiction where you're reading because you're learning about submarines, you think. And he'd never been on a submarine. His stuff is all research. But the idea that you're learning something, even if it's a novel, that appeals to guys as they get older. You need a certain amount. It depends what your story is, but detail is good. You can't fake it.
I want to say that anybody who turns into a client has to know they're going to end up in stories and presentations like this.
More questions? Yeah.
This is kind of technical, and it may have more to do with an article than a publishing a book. And a lot of places where I need examples of, so these are things that are museums all over the world. I couldn't go to those museums personally, so a scholarly paper. If I wanted to get it published, get those images into the article in a magazine. How does that work? Who owns the image? How do I get permission?
Oh, it's a nightmare.
And is the author responsible, or is the publisher responsible?
Short answer is the author is.
Okay.
There are, you can negotiate anything,
yeah.
but the rule is that the author is, and it's much more complicated than you think.
Yeah, well, I think it's really complicated. So.
Yeah, so it's worse, even than that, because there's the underlying artwork, there's the photograph of the artwork, it might be owned by the rights. There's the book, and stuff that you get on the internet, just because you can download it doesn't mean you can use it. That is one of the biggest misconceptions that are running around today, and that's whether it's words or images. You cannot use them in your book just because you found them on the internet. So that whole question of rights is, and that kills a lot of books. I mean, but that's something you have to figure out if you're doing a visual book or if you're using text that you find that on the internet.
Just one quick follow-up. I had a client recently who started off his book with a quote from a Beatles song, and he contacted Sony for permission.
Oh.
And they said $300 for the first 500 copies, and then we're going to have to renegotiate. So getting permissions is a big deal and a lot of work.
This is a sort of tangential question to the general discussion, but related to this last question. Do you guys know of good sources to find public domain works from Michael Apsinger's writings, especially for young adult fiction, outside of Gutenberg
That's really old. Like what do you mean? Are you whole books or?
As I said, it's tangential. It's a separate separate question from writing. It's actually more on the publishing side. But when you're looking for public domain material, I imagine there's a lot of it out there. But I don't.
Yeah, then you can.
I'm going to go and taking a break.
Okay.
I'm running away from home.
No. No.
Yeah.
You can look. You can search catalogs by date. You can look in online. I mean, there are a number of ways people collect it. You know, but I don't have. There's not a single way. Did you want to? Are you asserting yourself? Are you taking?
I was just wondering. I couldn't quite hear the question.
Public finding public domain stuff.
You mean like photos or?
Everything. Is there a way to get to public domain stuff easily? And the answer is not really. There are lots of ways, but I don't think there's a single way.
Like, for example, if you're looking for historic pictures, is it Creative Commons?
But that's not a place. That's a kind of license. Wikimedia, which will tell you what the license
is. Wikimedia work?
For the things that they have.
Mm-hmm. I guess if you're looking for sort of almost just a list of books and what's public domain and what's not. I'm actually starting a printing and publishing business in Africa, and we
don't worry.
Keep the price of the books down as cheap as possible, and one of the ways to do that is
just take it.
Find free content. No, nobody's paying attention anyway, right? I know it's tempting, but
you know. What,
and then being a wannabe author on the other side of things, I would feel pretty guilty.
While David's gone, I did these little handouts. They're kind of random. These are some sources for information. No, these are other ones. So these are some sources for information that writers you can find helpful. There are varying degrees of usefulness. If you could take one and pass it.
Asked about paintings, if you go directly to the museums, which paintings are
Yeah, that would be super.
They had to get published. They had to get permission to get. You need to go to the original source.
So this is just something, you know, links to different sources of information. The one that's most interesting, I think, relevant to this, is Writers Beware, which is something that the science fiction and fantasy writers compile, and they review things like freelance editors and vanity presses and self, they just have become a clearinghouse for who's ripping you off, who's not ripping you off. So I would strongly recommend number two, the Writers Beware, and then I even gave you the link to Writers Beware for editors. And so that's on number two. And then one and three are just general collections of information, one from Novelists Inc., which I'm not necessarily endorsing. It's just that they have a lot of different perspectives there, and Sisters in Crime, which is a very good organization that has a lot of information about for writers in general, not just mystery writers. So I thought that might be helpful.
You're suggesting that we start winding down. So you suggest that we start winding down.
Okay.
So
there should be tons. Yeah. Does anyone have any other questions? Yeah.
First, you were talking about men's trends in reading. What's about women's trends in reading?
I don't know that there is clearly. I mean, there's that it just clearly follows that a definable pattern. It might. I just don't know. I mean, there's more romance read. There's more serial killers read. but I don't know that it's translatable. I don't know that there's as much of a change for women as there is for men. But I just don't know. Be good to know.